has written of you in a book that I will give a synopsis of, a brief review of. It will probably be longer than desirable, but his view is probably worthy of consideration, a view of ruling class rot of Imperialism USA. Watergate, what did it all mean? While the question has never been answered, rarely has recent history presented a better opportunity to study the contradictions of the modern bourgeoisie state. In the rise and decline of the Nixon administration were both high drama and low comedy. Backroom gossip and food for thought. The events touched upon and were related to the Vietnam War, superpower rivalry, the relationship between the state bureaucracy and finance capitalism, imperialism, the relatively independent power of the military and police organs, especially the intelligence operations of USA de facto fascism, the tendency of the bourgeoisie state to experiment with its ever-present fascist alternative in moments of crisis, and much more. But a full historical materialist analysis of the period has not yet been made. In the meantime, let us in Jones' time take time to look at Haldeman's, H-A-L-D-E-M-A-N-S, Inside View. But we will have to settle for the fascinating array of first-hand accounts of the Watergate days by its unsavory cast of leading fascist actors, the latest of which has now been provided by Richard Nixon's one-time chief of staff, chief of his entire staff, H.R. Haldeman. The long-awaited publication of Haldeman's book, The Ends of Power, brings to light a mixture of sensationalistic speculation and some nuggets of political insight. Where one ends and the other begins is sometimes hard to tell. Note certainly that when you are dealing with pathological liars who work for capitalism, it is certainly conceivable that the pathological lying is going to continue when they want to do an expose for personal profit. Anyway, Haldeman's most explosive comment is his charge that in 1969, the Soviet Union proposed to the Nixon administration that a joint U.S.-Soviet nuclear surgical strike be directed against atomic facilities in Nationalistic Communist People's Republic of China. The accusation has been categorically denied by Moscow and TASS. TASS was a news agency that came out and did a story on us. The Soviet press agency called it a lie from beginning to end. It has even been disputed by both Henry Kissinger, then Nixon's national security advisor, and former Secretary of State William P. Rogers. And Kissinger certainly had no love for the USSR, so there'd be no reason for him to cover. Haldeman himself offers no corroborating evidence or proof evidence except to say that Nixon turned the so-called proposal down. He does make out a credible argument, hardly original, that the Soviet leaders may well have been contemplating a nuclear attack on China because of a renegade foreign policy moving away from internationalism on their own, however, in 1969. The Soviet military buildup on the Chinese border in that period is now common knowledge, and there seems little doubt that atomic weapons were part of the show of strength. Haldeman claims that Nixon signaled Moscow to the effect that the USA and China had common interests and a Soviet nuclear strike might bring the Russians into confrontation with the USA. These moves, he asserts, prevented what would have been a worldwide catastrophe. Nixon, in other words, saved the day by informing the Soviets that the USA saw some positive advantages in the future of common economic interests and so forth with People's China. That certainly proved to be the case. There's more than a bit of self-serving commentary in Haldeman's tale. However, the man who admits that he was Nixon's son of a bitch is out to prove that Watergate is not the story of the Nixon presidency. Rather, Haldeman believes that if it were not for the relatively minor folly and tragedy of errors that Watergate represented, Nixon would have carved out one of the greatest reigns in history. A solid structure for world peace would have been established, along with a sound internal economy, writes Haldeman. President Nixon would have achieved his oft-stated objective of a full generation of peace in this world and prosperity without inflation at home. Such blind enthusiasm is somewhat sobering. It certainly calls into question Haldeman's grasp on reality, even taking into account his natural inclination to justify an unanswering fascist loyalty to his one-time chief. All the more reason, therefore, to give credence to some of the senior revelations and speculations in The Ends of Power. Perhaps the most fascinating sections of the Haldeman book have to do with his all-too-brief excursions into the dominating political event of those years, the Vietnam War, and Nixon's reaction to the mass anti-war movement at home. Haldeman describes, in the ex-president's own words, Nixon's strategy for ending the war. I call it the madman theory, Bob. I want the North Vietnamese to believe I've reached the point where I might be or do anything to stop the war. We'll just slip the word to them that, for God's sake, you know Nixon is obsessed about communism. We can't restrain him when he's angry, and he has his hand on the nuclear button. And Ho Chi Minh himself will be in Paris in 2 days begging for peace. And, says Haldeman, this was precisely the theory that Kissinger took with him to the Paris peace talks. A threat of egregious military action by an unpredictable U.S. president who hated communism, coupled with generous offers of financial aid if they would stop the war before they were blown back into the Stone Ages. So Kissinger did follow that line. If nothing else, this last phrase confirms the Vietnamese charge that the U.S. reneged on its promise of financial assistance to heal the wounds of war. But the nuclear rattling strategy did not work. Henry, says Haldeman, found the North Vietnamese absolutely intractable. They would not even negotiate, even though they were threatened with nuclear destruction. And the reason was clear. No threat and no offer could obscure one great fact known to the world at large. The American people had turned against the war. The young were saying they would not fight it. And on the battlefield, people were showing no enthusiasm for it. They wouldn't even carry their pack. They'd throw their food away. They trembled in their trenches. And a communist must never be intimidated by fear. So we learn a great lesson from the North Vietnamese. Much of U.S. bellicose actions in the past would have to come out of that degree of narcissism because they want to live so badly. Capitalists, no matter how miserable their existence, they're even struggling for power within their own families frequently, like the oil-rich J. Paul Getty, who was even suing his own children and his grandchildren and put bay telephones in his house because he never had enough of the world of cash. Nonetheless, even though they're unhappy, they seek almost immortality, trying to stay alive. They never quite make it, like Howard Hughes, who ends up dying worse than a member of the slum, neglected in medical treatment Even a good doctor could have saved his life, and he died an agonizing death because money cannot buy peace. In fact, it often buys your death because you're always something of a object to try to get to and get out of the way if they can get what you own. Of course, the madman theory wasn't all that new. Nixon himself had seen it used successfully against the Soviet Union in the past. Haldeman's account of it as a self-conscious strategy and the refusal of the Vietnamese to knuckle under to it inevitably recalls Mao Zedong's criticism of the way in which the Soviet Union put the question of peaceful coexistence ahead of the demands, just after Stalin, of national liberation struggles because of the perils posed by the U.S. nuclear threat. But it wasn't hard for Khrushchev to know in those days. An honest human being, it'd be very hard for them to know how diabolical a capitalist is, that they'll bluff, they'll posture, they'll do anything, they'll take any role. They are amoral. They would sell out their own mother. It would be hard for a principled communist to relate to this at all, particularly those who have been living in a communist environment of equality for many, many years. His bluff call by the Vietnamese, Nixon faced a problem. If he made a warlike move to convince the North Vietnamese he was serious, U.S. anti-war protesters, according to Hal Haldeman, would explode in riots. Once again, assuring the communists that they didn't need to negotiate because Americans weren't behind the war, Nixon's solution to this dilemma, which Haldeman thinks has been very unfairly criticized, was the secret bombing of Vietnamese supply routes in Cambodia, which killed many, many thousands of innocent people. Bombing in secret would get the message up to the North Vietnamese and prevent a flare-up of anti-war protest because it wouldn't be published in the newspapers, he explains. But this tactic also backfired when the story was made public by the New York Times, having had it first broken in Europe. As always, the socialist, more social democracies, or the Marxist states would be constantly leaking it, what was going on, to the world press. So finally, U.S. capitalist press, even though it's a reactionary arm to destroy all objections to the monopoly capitalist state, finally, the so-called free press, which is nothing but an arm of the monopoly capitalist rulers, finally does have to give some credence to what's really happening in the world. And the New York Times, which credited its information to administration sources, confirmation of it, that is, this in turn led to the search for leaks, because Nixon was really shook by that, and ultimately resulted in widespread wiretapping in the State Department and the creation of the Plumbers Unit. Since it was these same plumbers who got caught red-handed in the Watergate break-in 3 years later, Haldeman himself admits that without the Vietnam War, there would have been no Watergate. Haldeman is hardly the first to see this connection, and naturally he makes it in only the most limited way. Basically, his view is that Nixon had a legitimate and compelling interest in plugging national security leaks, but that he carelessly overstepped the bounds by utilizing the plumber apparatus for partisan political purposes. In other words, Haldeman justified all this wiretapping and police state tactics. He just said that he got a little careless and unfortunately got caught. That's the only problem Haldeman sees, not that he violated rights of privacy and set up a police state apparatus, but that he got caught. To put it another way, what has since become known as the COINTELPRO, COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, a real fascist cloak and dagger operation, was fine so long as it was used against radicals, the anti-war movement, black, Indians, and other third world groups. But it was foolhardy and courting disaster to employ the same fascist techniques against another sector of the ruling class. Of course, Haldeman would never put it that way, but his message is very clear enough as you read the book. What Haldeman does not take into account, however, and what Marxists must, is that rivalries, and contradictions within the ruling class can at times take on almost as antagonistic a form as do the more underlying class contradictions of capitalistic society. On another level, Haldeman suggests as much with a series of highly provocative hints of CIA involvement in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. He implies that Nixon had some knowledge of this involvement and that this was one of the levers he was able to use to enlist CIA cooperation in the Watergate cover-up, because Nixon knew that the Central Intelligence Agency, with our tax dollars, had murdered John F. Kennedy. As much as John F. Kennedy tried to please the warfare state by even threatening to bring an end to everything, a nuclear war over little Cuba, nonetheless, he didn't move quite in step with the military-industrial class, and so their cloak-and-dagger henchmen, CIA, had him killed. Watergate itself, all of which leads to what is really the prime subject of Haldeman's revelations. Watergate itself. While the ends of power adds a few illustrative details to what is already known as the Dolores Saga, Haldeman's principal contributions to the topic are in the realm of what must be considered highly educated speculations on the immediate causes of both the Watergate break-in and the subsequent cover-up. The principal assertion is that Richard Nixon himself caused those burglars to break into O'Brien's office, the head of the Democrat Party, the Democrat headquarters. This is hardly in the realm of astounding news, but Haldeman makes out a reasonable case for breaking into the Democrat headquarters and offers some substantial evidence or corroborative evidence to show that the real motivation behind the break-in was Nixon's consuming passion to discredit Democratic Party Chairman Larry O'Brien by proving that O'Brien had some shady financial relationship to billionaire Howard Hughes. Nixon was particularly peeved with O'Brien because of O'Brien's role in exploiting the expose of the relationship between a $400,000 campaign contribution by the International Telephone and Telegraph Corporation, ITT, which was one of the primary corporations in aiding USA and our tax dollars used to overthrow the beautiful people in Chile, of which we hear the song of Victor Jara that haunts our soul and should night and day, for all the tax dollars that we contributed that brought about the torture of a great man and tens and thousands of women and men just like him. And the decision also of the Republican Party to hold its 1972 convention in San Diego, which O'Brien brought to light some of Nixon's financial shady dealings. According to Haldeman's Charles Chuck Colson, Charles Chuck Colson, now converted to Jesus, close friend of Eldridge Cleaver as they go on the Jesus route, although Eldridge has had to drop out because the white Christians don't want Eldridge, even though he's been sanitized and born again, they won't allow him to come into their assemblies and speak because he's black. It just seems that poor Eldridge can't get himself white enough. The blood of Jesus just won't wash him clean enough to suit white racist America. And according to Haldeman, Chuck Colson, who's on the Jesus trip, was Nixon's personal hitman. That's a good thing. That's what makes a good Christian. He was a hitman. He was the one signed to do Murder Incorporated in various vendettas, which, to put it most delicately, bordered on the criminal always. And Colson was the one to whom Nixon assigned the job of getting O'Brien by any means necessary. Colson, in turn, employed Howard Hunt. Hunt hired Liddy, and the rest is history. All these above were CIA agents. As you know, Hunt was even located on the scene, the murder of Kennedy. Haldeman also speculates that the entire operation may have been compromised from the beginning by the involvement of the CIA employees and at least one participant who continued to be on the CIA payroll all through the time. Haldeman believes that the CIA was kept informed of the entire operation throughout. He also suggests that the break-in may have been deliberately bungled by CIA man James McCord in order to prevent Nixon from obtaining the dirty linen he was after. There's a thought that James McCord may had a moment of conscience that frustrated the grand design of Nixon that would have thrown USA into an open de jure police state, a fascist police state in fact, instead of a de facto one, one that operates as fascism but doesn't have to have world criticism for having the machinery of fascism due to the apathetic, stupid mentality of the American populace. In the long run, the precise motivation for the Watergate break-in is probably not too important, except to show Nixon's central involvement in the affair from the beginning. More important is what happened afterwards. Here it is, Haldeman's view, that as the Watergate cover story began to come apart at the seams, various power blocks in Washington, each with its own reasons for wanting to curb the Nixon presidency, in effect joined forces in order to bring Nixon down. They may not even have had driving Nixon from office as their objective, because the ruling class doesn't want the kind of division and insights brought out that were shown about how evil the leadership, the administration of monopoly capitalism can be in a presidential administration. But there's contradictions, as you know, in capitalism. Nixon was never too kind to the press, even in spite of it so willingly doing the biddings of the multinationals and finance capitalism or imperialism that runs U.S. affairs and unfortunately bleeds 60% of the world of their right to live by the machinations of the Trilateral Commission. Nixon was sort of his do-it-his-own-self style, a kind of Hitler individualism that capitalists become afraid of. They set them up like Britain and England set up Adolf Hitler. But they're afraid that maybe Nixon would become another Adolf Hitler, probably, and be too independent of the real ruling families, because Hitler got rather independent of the real main families that run Europe and America at that time, Rockefeller, Rothschild. He sort of dictated to them sometimes, and the ruling class does not like that. They want their dictators to be representative of their will. And as you know, Rockefeller's the main interest, and DuPont, Farben, and others are the main families that rule the whole world of finance capitalism that remains, imperialism that remains. At the beginning, the ruling class might have thought solely in terms of deflecting or crippling the authority of the man who had just won the most overwhelming political victory in U.S. history. These power blocks of contradictions in capitalism, according to Haldeman, were in order of their importance the press, the bureaucracy, the Congress, and the vicious fascist intelligence community that's been at work in USA for time immemorial. Each of them was under threat by the president in January 1973, who was at the height of his popularity with the American people. Each of them reacted with special ferocity because that president was Richard Nixon, too highly individualistic, too unpredictable, on his own power mission rather than just a power mission for the ruling class. And that's the contradictions of capitalism that will finally bring its own rot. Clearly there is an element of truth in this analysis. But Haldeman, not being a Marxist Leninist, cannot see beyond the immediate manifestations of the contradictions that prevailed within the ruling class at that time. Nowhere is there mention, for instance, of the still unexplored role of the Rockefellers, the Trilateral Commission, in always having their own on-the-spot own loyalist, conveniently Johnny on the spot in the unraveling of the Nixon presidency. Obviously, it would be simplistic to suggest some elaborate conspiracy behind Nixon's fall from power. Haldeman disclaims one, although much of his analysis borders on the conspiratorial. But in the tortuous disintegration of the Nixon presidency from the time of his second inauguration in January 1973 to his forced resignation in August 1974, are all the elements demonstrating the just below the surface bloodletting that typifies the fierce struggle for power within the U.S. ruling class. And there was a conspiracy in that Nixon was not following the dictates sufficiently of the Trilateral Commission. And time will show that his own family was threatened if he did not resign. There is also some insights that he threatened to push the nuclear button, but was undercut in that reference, that life almost became meaningless because he was in such a loss of prestige, suffered such a deflation of his ego. but he did have some elements of even capitalist decency when they threatened reactions against his own family. And he wasn't sure of the nuclear component. He wasn't capitalist or not brave enough in facing life. He still probably had some concepts of God and immortality, so he was a little hesitant in using his power, not knowing fully what he would unleash even upon his own family, or if he would successfully die in it, because capitalists have an unusual degree of narcissism. Anyway, he did not, and he resigned rather peacefully. Making such a point is the last thing on Haldeman's mind, that of the fierce struggle for power within the U.S. ruling class, but he did. But beyond the tidbits of gossip and self-serving diffusions of political speculation in the ends of power are the inadvertent hints of that underlying rot which is the essence of USA's imperialistic state apparatus in its age of accelerating decline that we call the senile stage of monopoly capitalism. And we shall continue with the news. Well, the great rich families on the Royal Queen Isabella, the British luxury liner, are trembling in their bootstraps as they continue to linger at sea, afraid to go forward, should or go blind, because the terrorists have said to remain there until they notify them of their demands, and not to make any efforts to search the vessel. And so everyone is more or less in limbo, stationary, somewhere outside the Azores. Everyone is afraid to move towards the vessel. As a result, it has brought the usual fascist reaction. The FBI is preparing attacks against U.S. terrorists and have rounded up several in several major cities. In tones reminiscent of the McCarthy Red Scare hysteria, FBI racist director William Webster, who belongs to four elitist clubs, you know. I shall never stop talking about that. Two sexist, four racist, anti-black. And refused to resign them in St. Louis, in Missouri, where he came from. Even when he was up for Senate confirmation in the Senate, passed on Carter's appointment of him to this awesome power as director of the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation. He was also the wicked judge that handed down all the decisions, Webster was, against the Indians at Wounded Knee. So everyone can see, you wonder how our people have gone out, now start talking about the goodness of USA and how we attacked USA, and they're trying to get all this congressmen whipped up with letters because we're against USA, see how evil it is, and they were beguiled when it's really a beautiful country. Can you imagine some of our black ex-members and white members signing that? Now we attack God, whom they now love. The idea that they're worried about their families being brought up not loving God and red, white, and blue, good old USA. Really sickening. Wonder how they convince themselves to carry on this kind of a campaign. They surely cannot believe the lie when they see the epidemic of racism, the outbreak of Ku Klux Klanism, the murder of black men that are hung by hand and foot, and then have the state have the nerve to call it suicide, the shooting down of the remaining Attica resistance of black and white alike, police entrapments, murder of youngsters on piles of wood burned alive with a goat on top in sacrifice, young men sentenced to death, even though the witnesses say that they were forced by the prosecutors to lie, and yet two black young men will be executed in Alabama on the 10th of next month. Their last stay of execution has been denied. Now there's a new epidemic of terrorist activity, anti-terrorist activity, all through Europe and the United States. Webster's appealing that the Bureau has high priority preparations underway to meet these alleged threats. Because of this boat now, this cruiser, everybody's going crazy. Webster has held another news conference, second since he's taken office. He said experience tells us that when you have epidemics of this kind of terror it's very likely to come to our own leaders here in the United States if it did not start right here with the weather underground. We will be prepared to meet whatever eventuality with all the force that is required, said the good fascist FBI director, Webster. Webster said that the FBI is conducting anti-terrorist training classes at its Quantico, Virginia Training Academy, has brought in expert European instructors, is developing sophisticated profiles of all the potential radical, as he calls now radicals and terrorists the same, and is maintaining close liaison, close connection with the Army's anti-terrorism program, which the Army has now adopted. A continuing news media, mass media campaign, always the obedient servant of the ruling class, the newspapers, prominently citing the opinions of so-called experts on terrorism, is apparently, evidently, and openly trying to revive the Red Scare witch hunt hysteria of the 1950s and extolling the need for a centralized, high-level fascist-like government authority to meet this so-called envisioned threat. For example, Dr. Irving Goldbatter, a Miami-based sociologist and who is a private consultant on terrorism, decrying the alleged conspiracy among radical groups to take over cruisers and to kidnap men like Aldo Moro and execute them for crimes done against the people, as was done in Italy, and the radical activity of the Red Army in Asia, Japan, and Third World Liberation movements, said the irony is that the terrorists, such as the Japanese Red Army and the Palestinians, have a network of coordination at various levels. But we have not reached the point yet in this country where we have a cooperative relationship among local police jurisdictions, state agencies, and the federal government. He said we must meet their terror with terror. Senator Abraham Ribicoff, apologist for Zionism of Connecticut, has introduced legislation to create a council to combat terrorism, the CCCT, to be headed by an assistant secretary of state and an assistant attorney general. Dr. M. Sharif Bassiouni, B-A-S-S-I-O-U-N-I, professor of international criminal law at DePaul University in Chicago, and a government advisor that's been quickly called into service on terrorism, has called for the U.S. government to create a national task force for the prevention and suppression of all forms of radical dissent and terrorism to determine national policy and coordinate it. However, Bassiouni acknowledge the danger of encouraging government to repress individuals. The real danger I've sensed in this proposal of some people who are purportedly experts on terrorism, that we could easily move in the direction of having everyone get up and check under the bed for terrorists every morning, he said. We will be living in a police state that's even worse than the terrorism we combat, said another. The FBI has been under heavy attack due to recent disclosures of past massive illegal criminal spying activities and use of violence against black activist groups and socialist groups and various other anti-terrorist activities that they've conducted criminally, which Webster conceded he cannot assure is not continuing. In fact, the past FBI director of the heat was on so much in the world press that they had to arrest Patrick Gray and indict him, the past director of the FBI, for criminal acts of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He's a fall guy. Once out of office, you're the fall guy. I don't know why capitalists take any courage at all, no matter if they're the heads of FBIs or how powerful they are in government, they're the fall guys. Nobody in Congress has been indicted for the scandals, the bribes, and the payolas from the Korean South Korea CIA in the support of that dictatorship. But as one or two have left office, they've been indicted, both Republican and Democrat. The only safety a capitalist has is in accumulating power. And you can't accumulate power in capitalism because everybody else is looking after his own power base. So the only power people really should look for is the power to the people. Then you have security. When you guarantee a democratic, egalitarian power concept to all the people, such as we have here in this great community of communism in Jonestown. Webster is blasted by black and Indian groups as a modern-day Adolf Hitler. from his confirmation hearings in February till the present day, when he refused before the television eyes of the nation to resign from all four of the white social clubs to which he belongs that are racist and sexist. He arrogantly declared, "I don't think, as the new leader of the FBI, the first thing to do is to ask, have you stopped beating your wife? That's my business." He said he has talked to FBI agents across the country by means of a closed-circuit videotape in which he urged them to uphold the law and act with professionalism and not use unprofessional shortcuts unless the situation got serious. But now, of course, the situation is serious. Shortcuts means to violate law. The law never was meant for the protection of the people anyway. It's meant for the protection of the property interest, the monopoly capitalists. Webster refused to comment directly on the case of John Kearney, a former supervisor at the FBI's New York City office, who was also indicted for various bureau anti-terrorist activities and criminal activities against the people of the United States, including charges of conducting illegal wiretaps, interfering with the mail, using violence against people when they were searching them, and also doing other criminal acts against such underground groups or radical groups as the Socialist Workers Party and the Radical Weathermen Group. Well, this is the theory of the Weathermen and the theory of the new proletariat nuclei, the international proletariat nuclei, and the Red Brigade, the Red Army of Japan, Red Brigade of Italy. You have to bring about violent activities inside the society that will threaten the ruling class to really show their true evil, repressive nature. And in so doing, it is their theory, as the violent exponents, most radical exponents of violence under Marxist-Leninist banners, that by so doing, then the working class will have to unite against a common enemy. Let us hope that their theories are well taken. It could preempt nuclear war, but in most opinions, even the most moderate scientists, nuclear war is coming anyway. So perhaps it's time that people get on with being true to what they are, and that is to bring about Marxist-Leninist revolutions as the only hope to a starving world where 2 out of 3 babies are going to bed hungry. Anyway, the activity has begun, and USA is stepping up all kinds of internal vigilance. Police and FBI have been computerized into a central control, and there's all sorts of police planning on every level. The police state is being made very open in the last few hours in the United States. Lying belly down, low, coal miners find each day a test. The roof is only some 25 to 30 inches high. The walls are wet and jagged. In Logan County, West Virginia, the sun never shines. This is the world of the 15,000 workers of the U.S. who mine low coal in that area. They're on their knees, neck and back bent, for over 8, sometimes 10 hours, 6 days a week, for 30 or 40 years until their body breaks. Shoveling coal, moving thick timbers for roof support, carrying 50-pound sacks of supplies. With this winter's coal strike that just ended because no amount of trade union cooperation would support it, bringing the economics of coal into the public eye, the human side behind the wage demands often remains obscure. For those in West Virginia alone, in Logan County, the 15,000 low coal miners scattered throughout the southern Appalachian Mountains, and then there are thousands more in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Alabama, Illinois, Utah, Colorado, and all other major coal states, each workday is a test of real endurance of fascist oppression, a test of how much physical and psychological stress they can endure. The miners begin their day by riding flat on their stomachs for 5 miles into the earth. The ride is jarring, twisting and curving, jerking, kidney bouncer. "We don't eat breakfast anymore," says James Bragg, Jr., 32-year-old miner who works in the 25-inch coal mine in Logan County, West Virginia. "Riding in that way, laying on your belly, anything you ate, you know it. If you don't vomit it up, you can't stand the rest of the day. The coal seam, and therefore the workspace, may narrow to as low as 22 inches and rarely fluctuates ever above 36 inches. Can you imagine being down in 2 feet space for 30 to 40 years? Can you imagine the apathy of the American worker that will endure that because of the religious opiate that tells him he'll die and go to heaven and be with Jesus one day for being a good worker for capitalism? Any sensible people would die rather than continue that kind of existence. But they're given their little liquor bit after they get their check. They get drunk on the weekend, somehow keep on keeping on till they die of the average age of 44 years of age. Even the white miners die at 44 years of age of black lung disease and crippling arthritis. The workers need knee pads to keep their skin from rubbing raw as they crawl, and the company won't provide that. So the wives have to make bandages that will support their knees, and often use safety shoes with steel plates on the outside to keep the toes from wearing out. And the company doesn't provide those. They have to take those out of their salary also. Sometimes needing both hands as they crawl to their machines, they may use their mouths to carry their lunch buckets. They pray the roof won't fall. You think you've got hard work here. You think you have problems when it's your own land that we're developing. We should do it with such enthusiasm. We should emancipate ourselves from our old images. By the way, I want to tell the women that they better do something about getting a hold of their own identity tonight, and the men to do the same. Young men need to speak up and to show that they've been creating an image of what they want in a woman that is wrong, and women are going to have to reject being that image because you have no self-worth other than in a man's eyes. That makes you worse than the slave that's in the coal mine. There is the women's meeting and the men's meeting tonight. It's got to come from young people. I'm tired of talking on the subject. Yes, you pray that you won't have a roof fall in. In fact, they have a special dread of any kind of accident because they know how hard it will be for their buddies on their knees to carry them to transportation 5 miles deep inside the mines. The work is even more dangerous than mining in higher coal, which itself is 3 times more hazardous than the national average for industrial operations. With almost no clearance above the 20 to 30 feet long machines, the workers cannot see where they are going any of the time. They have to lean out the side while being careful not to crush themselves against the mine walls. They think you have the wide open spaces, and we goof off. That's why the observers will step up their reporting, and so will the stewards, coordinators, and supervisors of every crew and division, be it in agriculture, be it in medicine, be it in education. We will produce this land. We should be more grateful, and we will demand gratitude when the American worker lives in such a hell as that, and even when he's white. We have land 30 miles round ours, and we're not developing it like we ought to. The thing that scares me to death, said one, about low coal is running into somebody else on the side of the machine where I can't see them, says Blaine Lester, 6 foot, 250-pound miner with the usual obesity from having too much starch in his meal, unable to afford a proper diet, who barely fits into the 2.5-foot spaces. He can hardly squeeze into it. It's like being shoved in a box. He said it's worse than death. When I come around the corner with that cutting machine, I've just to guess where I'm going and hope nobody's in the way. According to Lester, a major safety problem is that the low conditions encourages shortcuts in work procedures. In any mine you work in, there will be foremen trying to get you to work faster, whether it's safe or not, whether there's enough air, he says. But it's more common in low coal because it takes longer to do it right. If they're going to put up roof supports or shovel loose coal so there won't be any explosions. Federal mine safety officials estimate that 1/2 of the deaths from roof cave-ins, the number one coal mine killer, could be prevented by the use of steel canopies or cabs to protect machine operators from falling rock, but the capitalists won't put out the expense. And the U.S. government, which is the government of the monopoly capitalists and not the people, for 40 years, even though it's been recommended, will not recommend that these steel canopies or cabs be built. So one half of all the deaths in the mines are from roof cave-ins, making people, when it doesn't kill them, vegetables for the rest of their life. But mining equipment manufacturers generally have failed to design canopies or cabs for even the 30-inch coal, according to mine safety experts. One typical cab delivered for use at West Virginia Mine confined the machine operator to a space of 20 inches high, 22 inches wide, and 45 inches long, with a door less than 15 inches high. That's the cab he had to work in. In 30-inch coal, you find all the health and safety problems of the coal industry, says Richard Cooper, a safety inspector for the United Mine Workers. The people who design the equipment, the capitalists who make it, often have never worked in a coal mine and don't give a goddamn. There's no attempt at special training for low coal miners. And the government inspectors of the USA give the companies too much leeway just because certain safety regulations cost too much money for the monopoly capitalist big business to comply with. Despite the dangers, thousands of miners continue to work in the 25-inch coal because there are few other jobs available in the isolated regions in which they live. Young men and women often find employment more easily at mines with low coal than at other operations where they would compete for jobs with older, more experienced workers and would not have enough to feed their families. I don't like it at all, to be honest with you, says Bill Curry, a young miner who left a good job in Chicago so he could raise his family in his native state of West Virginia. I think it's a hazard to my health. I know I'm going to die at an early age, especially eating all that coal dust. All the older men here are dying from black lung. That's what I was mentioning, silicosis disease, after so many years of eating the dust. But how else can I make enough money to live on? How can I stand to see my babies hungry? During his first weeks on the job, Bill Curry brought a washcloth to work so he could wash his face and hands before eating lunch. But the other men laughed at him, and soon he could see their point. After crawling around through the dust, the water, the miserable grease, and loose coal all morning long, how could he pretend while lying on his side on the mine floor where he had to lie because he couldn't sit up to eat that the grime could be overcome with a little washing? That's the plight of U.S. mine workers. That's the plight of the mine workers that almost chose starvation in a 115-day strike rather than continue in their miserable conditions. But the AFL-CIO, under the control of the bosses of monopoly capitalists like George Meany, would not give one cent of their slush funds, all the welfare funds they had, to enable those miners to hold out for decent safety conditions and health conditions. They weren't seeking more wages. They just wanted to be able to live, not be cramped into 20 inches sometimes and 25 inches, and be able to eat their breakfast rather than having to vomit it up, having to crawl on their bellies for 5 miles every day in the coal mines. Only one union, USA, backed up their demands, the communist garment workers. They brought food and supplies to their families, but the leaders of the communist garment workers in New York were charged with conspiracy. I guess it's conspiracy to feed hungry children, sons and daughters of the miners. I hope we realize what we have before it's too late for some of us. I don't mind, because every time I hear Victor Hara, I see the insane superficiality of some of our people, their lack of self-awareness, their games that make monkey sex look more attractive. It makes even the breeding of plants more interesting. Causes me to want to hear Victor Hara's song and wish I could have been sitting in his seat so I could have given a smile to some people that needed it and could have kept that smile on my face while my fingernails were torn out, my eyes plucked out, my fingers cut off. It would have been much easier than having to watch people who don't give a continental damn, who don't want to be socialist, and you sometimes wonder if they ever will be socialist, who are so boring in their sexual games and their sick sadomasochistic dependencies. Even U.S. magazines are calling romance now an addiction worse than drugs. When a person breaks up one, they go find another drug addiction that's even stronger because of their sick passivity and dependency. Oh, my God, socialism, let us clear our minds of the cobwebs of this old pattern, this coupling, sick, moony-eyed coupling off, the weak kinds of individuals that we encourage because we really want a robot. Unfortunately, capitalist men have always wanted just a robot in a woman, something they could wind up so she would move her hips at the right time and grunt on order and pick up after them upon demand, but not think, not talk. But surely socialist men require more, and if socialist men don't, then capitalist socialist women should not be capitalist slaves. They should demand their emancipation, because when you don't have anything in your brain, a man will take care of you in time. He will take advantage of you. You better cultivate your mind, because one time, sometime, you'll get bored. You'll be too bored. The old boy will be too bored with you. If you don't get something on your mind and some ability to relate to the community, do some kind of work in the community, you'll be left for another, because men have a Don Juan homosexual complex anyway. They have to move on from flower to flower, and you better keep yourself interested. You better be interesting to him, and the only way you can keep real interest is to cultivate something worthwhile in the man, a socialist consciousness. Develop some real thinking, then you will be the master of your fate, the mistress of your fate, woman of the revolution. Then you will be of help to liberation. Otherwise, if we can't get on with liberating ourselves, I hope that some of us will have the opportunity of being tortured in concentration camps. I would like it. Standing up, being sufferably 10 years, wouldn't make any difference how long. How much suffering, anything better than watching superficiality. So let's play Victor Hara every now and then and try to identify with him. You can't identify with your father. Seems just too impossible. He's too close at hand. You take him too much for granted. He's always there. He's always there. Brown sends planes to South Korea, assures allies of Asian presence. The Pentagon is rattling its imperialist saber in the direction of Asia, particularly at the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Defense Secretary Harold Brown, who also conducted many, oh God, inhumane experiments on controlling populations, eliminating populations in the ethnic weapons study, he was involved in it, is now the horrifying Defense Secretary of Carter. He said that the Carter administration will increase its air strength in the fascist state, the puppet state of South Korea, with the addition of at least 12 dozen F-4 fighters in the next few months. 2 days later, in a speech before the Los Angeles World Affairs Council, Defense Secretary Harold Brown revealed that the U.S. intends to bolster its strategic nuclear arsenal in Asia and modernize the Pacific Fleet. The announcement follows a secret memo which Brown sent to the service chiefs earlier this year. Brown suggested the chiefs establish quick strike forces based in the USA and consisting of several new Army and Marine units for intervention in the Persian Gulf and Korea. Brown's speeches in Los Angeles and Honolulu, Hawaii, were designed to offset fears in Asia that the 1979 defense budget and the direction of U.S. military policy are focusing too heavily on conventional NATO forces. At the Honolulu, Hawaii news conference, the defense secretary explained that USA monopoly capitalists had planned to strengthen air power in fascist South Korea over the next 5 years anyway. The decision to send the planes early, he said, was an effort to reaffirm U.S. support for the dictatorship, the bloody dictatorship of South Korea. The F-4 is the U.S. Air Force chief tactical fighter plane. Brown and other military officials who raised the possibility of even further increases in fighter power as the U.S. proceeds with plans for limited troop withdrawal from South Korea have not been kept. U.S. word is nothing. It's meaningless. In Los Angeles, Brown told the audience of academic and business leaders, "We are and will remain a major force in the Pacific. It cannot be otherwise. We cannot be strong in Europe and weak in Asia." The defense secretary, known for his cruelty before he even came to the Carter administration, outlined the advanced weapons systems that the USA monopoly fascist will introduce into the Pacific theater over the next 5 years. The systems include Trident nuclear missiles, cruise missiles for B-52 bombers, F-15 fighter planes, and an aerial warning and control system. Brown contended that the military buildup is essential because of U.S. uncertainties concerning the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which is a close ally of Guyana and called us the only truly communist cooperative that they've seen. Vietnam and relations between the Soviet Union and People's China are also uncertain. So, I want to repeat that again. Brown contended that this military buildup that's coming this week is because of uncertainties concerning communist North Korea, the DPRK, Vietnam, and relations between the Soviet Union and People's China. I am concerned, said Defense Secretary Brown, with what can only be termed a misconception about our policy. That is the belief expressed sometimes at home and sometimes abroad that the U.S. is simply withdrawing from Asia, even though that was a promise of the USA. They're not going to keep it. That perception is quite simply wrong. He openly breaks the word just now as the word is being broken with the Indians, broken with the blacks, all the assistance, job assistance programs, CETA programs, broken. So we break our word at home and abroad. In closing of the news, the Katanganese, the Katanese are continuing a valiant struggle, still inside Zaire, though being pulverized by Belgium and French Sabre and Mirage jets. USA has manipulated the Belgians and the French to do their fighting, though there are considerable war protests in Belgium. They still hold hostage some 500, and it is estimated that over 2,000 whites have been killed, caught in between the Zairean puppet army and the revolutionary forces of the Katanese, of the Katangan people, bravely trying to liberate their land, which is the most rich uranium and cobalt area and other mineral ore areas of the entire world. The Soviet Union have their troops on the Angolan border. The Cuban presence is highly felt there too. USA has moved no troop movements because war is still unpopular with American youth. But USA is doing everything in its power to manipulate its puppet regimes of Belgium and France to do its dirty work in the former Belgian Congo area, where the CIA murdered one of the greatest black leaders of all time, Patrice Lumumba, in what is now known as Zaire, Z-A-I-R-E. Know your map. Know this for news, because you'll be tested on Friday. Always, some way or another, you'll be tested, either orally or in written tests. You'll be tested in People's Rally on Saturday, because we will have to get knowledge. It was frightening, and we saw some of the answers to questions. We've got to get more awareness. Some good people, sweet people. But when you give an answer that the enemy of communism is socialism, you're going to have to get on the ball and realize that knowledge is your only security. You can't give sensitivity to your children. You can't have loyalty to one another without knowledge, because only knowledge will give you the kind of thinking that you can give loyalty to one another with and be sensitive to one another with and be able to build a caring and sharing community. Finally, Egypt has rounded up now a total of 15,000 people. Five more newspapers have been shut down. Two television stations have been taken over by the government. Communist socialist parties have been banned. Trade union leaders have been arrested. Internment concentration camps have been set up. And the people did it to themselves. Only 58% of the people turned out to vote on a referendum that gave this kind of power to the Prime Minister Anwar Sadat of Egypt. And now only 54% of the people that came out voted for it. But now they're living under a virtual dictatorship. Egypt once was in the alliance of the Soviet Union, but the CIA cleverly had Nasser killed at a young age by some kind of chemical tactic. He died in his early 50s with a myocardial heart attack infarction. And now Egypt is rocking and reeling and was about to move out again from USA control. So USA, with its good advisors, CIA advisors, have recommended Nasser to set up a dictatorship to eliminate all of his opposition. And he's done so. The press was all capitalistic. but three newspapers have been closed, radios, television stations yesterday, and now more today. Even capitalists, who are no more communists than our dogs, have been arrested. Any opposition is coming down upon, they're coming down upon it heavy and hard. In the last of the news, cancer is a corporate plague, is the headlines, Voice of America and the BBC. What is the second leading cause of death in the USA? Cancer. And it soon will be number one. And the story behind the statistics is even more alarming. What is usually lost in the public...